You're very welcome to episode 5 of Ours to Protect with John Morey. This week's episode is all about green energy. We're going to be speaking to Dr. William Finnegan, who's the Assistant Professor in Civil Engineering in the School of Engineering at the University of Galway. So too his colleague Kieran Kennedy, who's a Research Fellow, and Tomás Flanagan, the CEO of Air Composites. Also be speaking to John McGarry, who is the Director of LP3. We'll be hearing from some of the local schools here in Galway, including Briarhill National School, Lacken National School, and St. Jarlett's College in Tuam. All this and a lot more on this week's episode of Ours to Protect. You can leave a text or WhatsApp to 086-3833-553, phone reception on 091-770-077, and email comments at galwaybayfm.ie. First, let's hear from the students of Briarhill National School and what green energy means to them.
Energy is a thing, is a power that makes different things happen, and there's different types of energy.
We get energy from energy plants such as water mills or windmills or wind power.
There's heat energy, light energy, mechanical energy, electrical energy, sound energy, water energy and wind energy.
And how can we save energy at home?
Well, first of all, we can turn the lights off when we leave the room. We can also put the washing machine overnight, as Ireland produces too much energy overnight, which gets wasted. So by using the dishwasher overnight, we can use that energy that would get wasted.
You're listening to Ours to Protect with John Morley. I'm at the University of Galway now, and I'm joined first by Dr. William Finnegan, who is an assistant professor in civil engineering in the School of Engineering at the University. I want to talk to you first about tidal energy, William. And before we do it, just give us the context. You do a lot of collaboration in the sector.
Right. Thanks, John. Thanks for coming in today. My role here is primarily a lecturer, but I also conduct a good bit of research through the MARI Research Ireland Centre and Construct Innovate, where our research is funded through various sources like SEAI, the Marine Institute, the European Commission, and Enterprise Ireland. So over the last few years, we've worked with a lot of tidal energy developers to help get their technologies out into the sea or out into operation. Where we come in is we look at testing their blades. So we look at the structural integrity. So how strong are the blades and will they survive loadings like fatigue loadings that they see over their lifespan? The research is mainly around, how can we make the sector more sustainable and more resilient and be able to operate in the harsh environments that we see offshore.
What are some of the findings in that regard?
Well, one of the tests that we did maybe 4 or 5 years ago now was with Orbital Marine Power, who have a turbine off the coast of Scotland. It's the largest tidal turbine in the world. And we did a test here that put the largest load ever applied to it. They've been operating now for about 3 years, and or the turbine's been operating for about 3 years, and they're looking to put even larger blades on too, so they're able to get more energy more of the time. We've also worked with Shuttle Hydro, and they had a deployment in Canada, and ORPC, who have an Irish entity here, that we've worked with on a number of projects that saw a deployment in Strangford Lough last year, but they previously had put a turbine in the water in Alaska. So in Alaska, they were in a remote community. So previously the diesel had to be airlifted in to then be converted to energy while they had a river running through as they were a fishing village. And so they put a turbine in the water, and it's been a bit of a game changer for them.
Must be said as well, it's award-winning research you're doing, and is there huge demand out there in the sector, and I suppose particularly with bodies like SEAI?
Yeah, I suppose the thing really driving it is the climate action plan. So there's a climate action bill that the government has signed up to, and SEAI, most people would know them from getting grants to retrofit your house or make it more energy efficient, but they also have an RD&D call each year. And through that, we've worked with a lot of tidal and offshore wind developers locally here in Ireland. So we've ORPC Ireland, G-Kinetic, Emerald Energies, Rockall Research, and I'm sure I've forgotten some, but we've worked with those over the last few years on various SEI projects to help boost technology in the sector.
Is it important for your goals as well as the university?
Yeah, so sustainability is one of the pillars within the university here. So we're constantly trying to work in a more sustainable way and contribute to societal targets around sustainability. Yeah, through our research, but also through our teaching as well. There's an energy systems engineering program here, which is a 5-year program, so 4 years to a degree and then a master's in the fifth year. And a lot of the focus there would be around renewable energy and essentially training the next generation of engineers who will make that difference in society. I myself work in civil engineering, and sustainability, similar to all of the engineering programs, is a key component, and it's actually one of the things we get assessed on from Engineers Ireland during the accreditation of each of our programs.
Just to finish up with the tidal, because some people might say that the likes of onshore wind or solar will be more commercially viable, is it good to have those as an option?
Yeah, so where tidal really comes into its own is, imagine nighttime where there's no wind blowing, you still have a predictable tide. So tides, you can predict them over the next 1,000 years. So you know you have that resource at night, while you don't have solar and you may not have wind. So it is available there 90% of the time. It's predictable. And where it'll add in here is to our energy security. So, like, we have this huge resource offshore, and if we are to exploit that, it would really bring Ireland into where we've moved away from fossil fuels, and we can try and meet some of these targets that we're aiming to. Like, we're supposed to have a target of 80% of our electricity from renewables by 2030, and to reach that, we need to have a fully secure renewable energy network, and tidal will be a key part of that.
I'm joined now by Kieran Kennedy, who is a research fellow at the School of Engineering at the University of Galway. I want to talk to you about wind, and particularly offshore wind, Kieran. What are the possibilities with it at present?
Well, I think you hear a lot about it, and offshore wind community are working hard on it. And there are some things that need to be cleared up. But I think the key thing is to look a little further ahead. And, in 50 years' time, there's going to be a lot of wind power in off Ireland. And Ireland is going to be one of the places in the world where wind power is, making electricity to power the world sustainably.
Because we are one of those key areas that have great potential to tap into wind as a resource.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's actually simple physics in a way. Like they call it, the old sailors used to call it the Roaring Forties. You know, and there was up at this end of the planet and down at the south end of the planet. There's I'm not an atmospheric scientist, but there's where the winds are, and so we get those strong winds that blow, as we all know, like hard and regular. So there's a great resource there that we can tap into and use it to produce this carbon-free energy, essentially, for all our daily needs.
Onshore is definitely the easier option at the moment. Lots of opportunities there.
Yeah, I mean, onshore is great. It's very much the first generation of wind, and we have kind of still got quite a few projects left to go there. And, as people get used to wind turbines, we find ways to allow them to be used in, where they don't annoy people. And that's the biggest concern, is that, some people hate the look of them, but that's one thing. But if it's, if it's really annoying you and you have to live close to it, then obviously we don't want to do that. So, but the technologies are evolving to cut down on the amount of noise that they create. So there's still opportunities out there and in Ireland.
In terms of offshore wind then, where do you see that developing in the next while?
Well, there's kind of two options on offshore wind. There's what they call fixed bottom, where the turbines are actually mounted on the seabed. And that we see that happening mostly off the east coast of Ireland. So the Arklow Bank, for example, already has some turbines, and there's more going to be put up there. There's also an array around Dublin that's going to be worked on. So those are, and then those are the fixed bottom. And then off the west coast, we'll probably have floating wind turbines. So they'll be actually floating on a floating platform moored to the seabed. And then that's how they'll be supported, essentially, to make that energy.
I was in your workshop. You really drilled down to the mechanics of it here. How important is that for developing wind, whether that be onshore or offshore?
Well, I mean, of course, as engineers, we think that's the most important thing, you know. So we need to put up machines that work and work for a long time, you know. So the average design lifetime of a wind turbine is moving up towards 20, 25 years. And that means that it can, you know, make energy for a long time. And we need to know that that's going to happen. So we need to understand the materials that are being used. And, you know, the scales are really large now. The largest wind turbine in the world is being put up in China at the moment. It's 25 megawatts, 153 meter blades. So obviously that is not something that you can just do on a wing and a prayer. Somebody needs to understand the engineering and the design that goes into that. So and the other thing about that for us is that it's a lot of the students find that really interesting. So the students get to come in here, they study. I mean, they have to do the basic engineering, but then there's usually something that drives that, and a lot of them are really keen on renewables because they know it's the future.
And are there any exciting Irish projects you're looking forward to in the future?
Well, there's a few proposals out there at the moment, and they're they're doing all the hard work of working through all those kind of planning permission, foreshore licenses, you know, that whole system is just being developed now. And while it seems incredibly slow, it is important that it gets done properly so that we can have an industry that goes out there and does good and does no harm, essentially, you know.
You mentioned the lifetime of the turbines as well. Recycling them, is that an option?
A lot of parts of a wind turbine are recyclable at the moment. Probably the big challenge at the moment is the actual blades themselves are made out of a composite material, a composite of glass fibers and polymers. And that's difficult to recycle at the moment. There are people who are working on, we have tested materials that are essentially recyclable, fiberglass. And then we're also involved in a project where we're looking at how we can recycle the already existing blades that are not thought of as a traditionally recyclable material.
I'm joined now by Tomás Flanagan, who's the CEO of Air Composites. I want to talk to you first, Tomás, about getting on board with the researchers here in the university and, I suppose, supplying the materials needed for this.
So Air Composites works with a lot of advanced materials, particularly carbon fibre and glass fibre. We've been around for about 25 years and we work a lot on aerospace, but what we're trying to do is to take those advanced materials into the renewable sector. And there we work on wind in particular, but also a bit on wave and on tidal. And the idea is if you can have better materials, you can make longer blades and capture more energy, make them more efficient, make them more durable.
How has that partnership been working so far?
It's been really, really good. So we hired the graduates from University of Galway, University of Limerick and other universities around Ireland. And there's a very strong calibre of candidates coming towards us. But they're also interested in working for us because there is a more of an interest now in renewable energy and sustainable materials than there would have been, say, 25, 30 years ago. So we're able to take some of the research that's coming out from the universities, but then try and develop that into products or components of large products for others, and then develop these devices that'll capture the tidal energy or wind or whatever we're trying to do.
And just on the materials, a lot of materials needed because we have huge targets to be hitting by 2030 and beyond that as well. But a lot of things are still caught up in the planning process. Is that something that you're looking at as well, to look forward to the different supplies that's needed and the different types of energy that's needed and the different materials they need?
We're looking at that a bit. We're looking as well at the sustainability of the materials that we use. So some of the materials that are used for the blades and wind turbines are very hard to recycle. So we're working on new materials that are more recyclable or more not based on oil. They're based on sustainable, so things that grow like flax or hemp instead of glass fiber in some cases. But there's a lot of work to be done there. And also the energy that's required to make these materials, huge amounts of energy goes into carbon fiber. So we've a project where we're looking at using microwaves instead of furnaces for that, and we can save about 80% of the energy. So there is an opportunity there, but it's still very early in that process.
What about floating wind? Are there possibilities in that going into the future?
We think there's an enormous potential for Ireland for floating wind. So Ciarán has touched on it a little bit already, but floating wind allows you to go out to sea where you've got better wind. You can put bigger turbines. Noise isn't a problem. Planning isn't a problem. And Ireland has a really big kind of real estate of ocean off the west coast and off the south coast. And there is also historically, there's been a lot of fishing off the west coast of Ireland, and that's faded a bit, but I think this could be a way to take that kind of ethos and to regenerate it along the coastal communities. And it will take time. There'll need to be, you know, investment in ports, and some of that is coming, but there's still really a lot to do. And I think the immediate phase will be the fixed bottom platforms, more in the east of the country. But then I'd say in the next 5 to 10 years, we'll see floating wind in Ireland. There's already floating wind in Norway and Scotland. There are a few other projects around the world, but there hasn't really been one here yet. So we're doing some research projects on scaled prototypes of that with the university. And we want to actually start with fish farms because they use a little bit of electricity and sometimes they're quite remote, but you can build a smaller prototype and test it out there. And then if it works there, build a bigger one for other applications.
What about wave energy? Is that a runner in Ireland?
I think it can be over the long term. There's some good companies working on that. There's a company called Ocean Energy in Cork who've done work on wave energy. Sometimes we've made components or test parts for them, and they have a really interesting project in Hawaii. We're also working with a company called Carnegie Clean Energy, who are based in Australia, but they're doing a project in Spain, and we're building 2 meter long springs for them that are a key component of their mooring systems. So there's a lot of wave energy there, but it's about trying to get the cost down to make it more sustainable. So again, that's back to building the prototypes, testing them, making them work, and then having cheaper materials or using less material to reduce the cost. So I think that's a little bit away before there'll be a lot of commercial devices, but it's probably part of the portfolio in the future.
And are there opportunities here for rural fishing communities in traditional areas, the likes of Connemara, to maybe benefit out of this, whether that be through employment or a spin-off employment?
I think certainly in the future there will be. It's not there yet, but like all up and down the coast, I think Rosseville in kind of the Connemara area, Limerick, Foynes, Port Cork, all of these places could become big hubs for renewable energy offshore.
Now it's time for the turn of Lacka National School. They told us all about what green energy means to them.
Energy is the force that causes things to move, and it's also defined as the ability for something to work or just like make things move, and it can produce light.
And can you name some things that use energy?
Laptops, showers, taps, sinks, phones.
There are a lot of things that use energy, especially in our homes, such as kettles, fridges, microwaves. Although water heating and cooling can be the most expensive.
There are many different types of energy. The most common would be electrical or solar, but there's also other forms, such as nuclear, thermal, and mechanical.
Why is it important to conserve energy?
Well, it's important to conserve energy because conserving energy is important to help our environment. We can do this by reducing the use of fossil fuels.
For example, sunlight can be harnessed through solar panels, converting it into energy. This electricity can power homes, business and other devices, but there's many other ways.
What kind of things do you do to conserve energy?
We turn off the lights when we leave a room, only use the TV when we really need it, close the door so that we don't have to turn back on the heat, and we only wash our clothes on a short wash.
Like, turn off the lights and stuff. Only really just use, like, the shower when I need.
And do you think you use a lot of energy?
Yeah, I think we do use a lot of energy.
What kind of things at home would you use?
We'd normally use the sink, mostly our showers. We'd use TV. We'd use the fridge. We'd use the lights. And we'd use kind of basic stuff that we'd need.
And you're welcome back to Ars to Protect with me, John Morley. Continuing with our look at green energy, and I'm joined now in studio by John McGarry, who is the director of LP3. John, just explain to us what you do here in Galway.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me. LP3 are a professional services provider. We work for developers who commission us to work on their projects. We can explain how that came about or how the name of the company came about. The L in LP3 stands for land. And then there are three P's, planning, project management and property. And that really speaks to our services and what we do.
So tell us a bit about what you do in terms of that connection between landowners and developers.
That's right. So, we would see ourselves, John, at being at the interface between developers and landowners. So we have a team of dedicated land managers who are out on the road every day. They're drinking tea, they're walking fields, they're building relationships, they're exploring interest in renewables. And that's all guided by wider technical assessments that point us and our land managers on behalf of developers to specific pockets of land within the country. The responsibility of our land managers is really to guide landowners through what can be a legal process whereby they have to sign an option to lease agreement with a developer that commits them to a project and to a particular developer on an exclusive basis, and then allows further funding for a development project to happen.
Mm. You said on behalf of developers, can it work the opposite way as well, where a landowner might say, look, I want to offer up my land?
Geez, it can, yeah. The developers, sometimes there's a variance between them in terms of appetite for risk, and we'll maybe get into the different types of constraints that projects have. One man's rubbish is another man's treasure in certain regards, and it's the same for developers, where some mightn't fancy the risk of the location of one project, but another might be quite happy to take it on and play that forward.
Let's talk through some of the different types. Onshore wind, for example, what are the considerations there?
There's a huge number of considerations. Bernie, who runs our GIS team, would tell you she could think of about 1,000 constraints that should be applied to a single piece of land whenever you're thinking about it. But one of the biggest or one of the most effective constraints that applies is this market practice of 4 times the tip height from any property. So if you're going into planning today, you should be, as a developer, 4 times the tip height of your turbine from any property location.
Okay.
And that is, from one point of view, is in effect sterilizing large pockets of land across the country from turbine development. But it's fair. It's referred to as a visual amenity setback. So that's considered by many to be far enough away from a property if you're 4 times the tip height.
Could there be changes in that regard? Because I know there are draft changes looked at and that could be coming down the tracks from government.
Yeah, I don't know if that one will change. Now, we'll have to wait and see. We're all holding our breath for updated wind energy guidelines, which were attempted to be brought in. I think the latest round was 2019 in a draft form. met with wide criticism based on some of the other considerations that were within that document. But we're promised that that is imminent, the publication of new wind energy guidelines. That will establish the rules for how planning applications are determined, for how sites are identified in the first place, and essentially what landowners are going to be approached by developers in the next wave.
What sort of reaction do you get from landowners when you say a developer would like to build a wind farm on your land?
We get a huge variance of reactions, okay? So it's not for everyone, and that's fine. Like, I'm from a farming background myself, and so is my business partner, George. We would always say that the decision is every individual's to make. But if you think about it, John, the fragmented nature of land across Ireland means that you've got, for a typical wind farm project of scale, possibly more than 20 agreements to make. That's 20 individual decisions. And if landowner A decides that it's not for them, that could impact the layout. It could make the entire project unviable. And the basic message from us is that, with the greatest respect, we're only presenting an offer to you or an option to you on behalf of a developer. Mm. The decision is yours. So what we want to do and what we deliver for our developer clients are option agreements. But behind those option agreements sit a huge amount of trust, whereby we've guided the landowners and given them the space to understand the various permutations and the things that they're signing up to in order for this to happen. But the decision ultimately is theirs.
Mm. And I know that this is quite a contentious topic, particularly in East Galway. In terms of the wider community finding out about these developments, what stage is appropriate for that? Should they find out when you're discussing with potential landowners here, or when should they find out?
Yeah, well, if you think about it, John, in a typical project where there are 20 landowners or 20 families, that is the community, or at least a section of the community. And my personal view is that the community have a right to be involved in the project. But what we want, and what I see our clients do, you know, we're working for some of the biggest and the best in show business. They really want to get those views at an early, appropriate stage and to understand it. If I could summarise the views of some that I speak to, it's that to understand that engagement is a two-way process. So developers will absolutely listen to the needs and the opinions of the community, but they also want to be listened to as well. And my suggestion is that most people are very positive about wind farms. That, you know, I can see even my own daughter building a wind turbine at primary school, and you know, little projects like that. It's really embedding in the culture that wind is the way. And I can just see that a real positive contingent coming through that are receptive and welcoming of turbines. It's the responsibility of the developers and our clients to site and scale those turbines appropriately. Mm. And that there's a huge amount of work that goes into making sure that that's the case.
Just on wind turbines themselves, what sort of land is appropriate? Do you need to be on a height? Do you need to be facing the prevailing wind? What are the considerations?
Yeah, let's think about it at a very early technical phase. The whole point is to catch the wind. If we're hidden behind a hill, or if we're in the middle of a forest, not in a windy part of the country, it's not going to work. You know, no one ever designed turbines for them not to be seen. Being seen is a byproduct of being tall to catch the wind. So that's the whole point of them, and that's something that we've been dealing with for centuries as a civilization, and trying to harness the power of the wind. The land, or what we find is that because turbines are now typically taller, and advancements in technology have been excellent, especially over the last 10 years, the tip heights of under consideration are taller, which means that we can open up pockets of the country that weren't before viable for wind, because we're accessing that pocket of the air that carries the wind more. what it means also is that because we're going into those areas which weren't typically considered viable for wind, is that you have these larger than they were blades being transported along roads, and that's a consideration for developers. So one of the top line checks, can I get there with the existing road infrastructure, or what do I need to do? So is there wind and can you get there?
What about for solar projects?
Solar projects, different set of constraints. You know, I would suggest that solar projects are typically more fragile on paper, and therefore for me, or what I see developers thinking about, is it's all about the grid. How far away is the grid? And if I need, if I'm a greater distance away from something and my cable is going to cost exactly the same amount, then I need more megawatts. So developers typically look at things in terms of a price per megawatt in order to understand if it's viable. But it's no different to the wind resources. Whenever it comes to talk about solar, you're looking at irradiance levels. You know, we talk about the sunny southeast of the country. That doesn't mean that the west or the northwest isn't viable. It just means that those other project considerations like distance to grid or developer support is all that more essential.
Are there different things to consider for battery storage then as well?
Battery storage has its place. Okay, there's probably at an earlier stage in delivery, and just as fragile for the market, for the industry, is the distance to grid. You'll find that land beside substations very valuable if it meets all the other viability checks, because developers are interested in thinking about battery storage projects in the future. But there's another type of battery out there, and that's the on-site battery that could be used almost as a hybrid scheme between, you know, a wind project with a battery or a solar project with a battery. These efficiencies can be excellent for the project and excellent for the country if they're deployed correctly.
Okay. And if people are interested in maybe getting a project like this on their land, what advice would you have, and could you give at LP3?
My suggestion might be to get in touch. LP3's website would have the details for that. But initially, what we would be thinking about are the high-level constraints. I was talking to someone about this just before I came in, who bumped into it at the ploughing yesterday. And if we think about it like a hurdle race, if you can't clear the first hurdle or those high-level checks, you're not going to continue the race. You're not going to finish. But what we would do is look at different series of constraints in a particular order, in a sensible order, that makes sense to progress.
John McGarry, the director of LP3, thanks for joining us on Ars to Protect.
Thank you, John.
Finally, let's hear from the pupils of St. Gerlet's College in Tuam about green energy.
Energy is what, like, powers everything that's electric and everything.
And what would be the main things you would use energy for?
Well, one thing that I use a lot at home that definitely uses a lot of energy, I'd say, is definitely the shower. Because, like, everyone in the house, like, takes a shower daily. And, like, it's, like, runs on electricity. So I think that uses a lot. And in school, I think, like, since there's, like, always, like, lights on and, like, classrooms, I think that also used up a lot of energy.
Your electricity and TVs and phones.
Why is it important to conserve energy?
It's important to conserve energy since, like, non-renewable energy, it'll eventually run out, so it's better to, like, save it instead of just spending it carelessly.
We could plug out any electronics we're not using, switch off the lights and make sure they're definitely off.
And can you tell me about any renewable energy solutions?
Like solar panels, wind turbines, hydroelectric power, those are good renewable energy sources, and investing in one of those could help you in the long run.
That is all from this week's episode of Ars to Protect with me, John Morley. My thanks to Ollie Werner for all his assistance in this episode. In our final episode, episode 6 of Ars to Protect, we'll be looking at recycling. Join us on the last Thursday of October.
Ars to Protect, brought to you by Galway Bay FM, the IBI, and funded by Commission Amman with the television license fee. Check out ars electricprotect.ie for more info.